You might open up your Bibles to the book of Romans, chapter 12, and we'll begin there in just a moment. I do appreciate those songs and the ones that were led this morning, and so very much the efforts made all along the way by song leaders to turn our thoughts in the direction that they're going to be dwelling on for the evening or the morning. And appreciate the time and effort that goes into the selection. We're going to continue, as I said this morning, looking at the subject of grief. And thinking about it, hopefully this evening, we worked our way down into grief this morning and thinking about working our way back up out of grief, getting through to the other side. And maybe even in an ultimate sense, getting through to the other side of grief. I want to begin then looking at that and thinking about that from the perspective of how do we address grief in others when we see somebody else who is in sorrow and grief. How do we respond to that? And this is probably the thing that gets written about the most when you're just reading about thinking about that. And so much of it, I think, is maybe doesn't ever get quite concrete and doesn't ever quite get to the point of really valuable information. In fact, a lot of it ends up being just sort of people being offended who are grieved. Don't ever say this to somebody who's grieving. And then they've got the top 10 things you should never say to somebody who's grieving. And it ends up really being, I think, pretty uncharitable to people who are really trying to help. Maybe people do say some things that are hurtful from time to time. But there's almost like no credit given for people trying to help. And I did listen to one lady that said, you know, the worst thing is people just avoid you altogether. I think you get some of that in Psalm 88 that we looked at this morning. I'm a stench in my acquaintances' nostrils. They don't want anything to do with me. And I think people feel that way sometimes when they're grieving. You just give them a wide berth. You don't know what to say. Let's just not say anything. And that's one thing if you're sitting beside them and not saying anything. No, let's just not even get near them. And so at a time when people feel maybe most lonely, they end up feeling even more lonely, right? And so because of that. And so, while I do want us to be thoughtful about how we approach people in grief, I also want to, as we're thinking through this, think from the perspective of giving charity to those who are willing to step out and do something and say something and come alongside as maybe we're the ones who are grieving. In thinking about that, that's what we find in Romans chapter 12 and in verse 15. Romans chapter 12 and verse 15, that familiar passage, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. As we talked about this morning, one of the aspects of grief that God's word, I think, instructs us in both an example and in command is far from coming up to somebody and saying, dry it up, time to move along, stop grieving. It's rather join in that grief as much as is possible. Sit down beside them in their grief and hold their hand in their grief. Even shed tears with them in their grief. And you may say, well, look, I don't operate that way. Tears don't come easily to me. I think in the same way that greet one another with a holy kiss is maybe a subjective command, right? Show some affection. I think the same thing is true here. Do what you're able to do to come alongside and show some grief. Brad came up to me this morning after the lesson, and one of the things Brad will say frequently is, good show. And so this morning after the lesson, he went, that's all I know. That's all I know to say. And I know what he meant by that, which is those are heavy thoughts. And I put a lot of words into that sigh. But in fact, in the Old Testament, comfort, that's the very word for it. It's just sigh. It's the word for sorrow. It's the same word, in fact. And it means to sigh audibly. That's one of the ways we can come alongside people and comfort them. So when you're feeling uncomfortable with someone else's grief, know that they're probably feeling uncomfortable too. How do you take away some of that discomfort? You can't take away the grief, but you can at least take away the awkwardness of it. It almost feels sometimes like inappropriate to be in sorrow because maybe other people aren't going through the sorrow that we're going through. I remember on an occasion in 2011 when the tornadoes came through and caused so much havoc. And in this area, I imagine there were a lot of sober faces after that particular day. So many people had lost so much. And it was all through the territory, right? You probably knew so many people. And maybe you knew some people who'd lost their lives even. In Montgomery, it didn't hit as immediately home. We were one of the few people who had lots of connections Birmingham northward. And we're getting images and pictures, and Amy and I are just bowled over. Her hometown was one of the towns that just got wrecked. And when we drove through it, we didn't even know where we were. We were disoriented. Her mother is just disoriented. And immediately after that, we went to a graduation party. And everybody's joyous, and Amy and I just were shell-shocked. And it felt so inappropriate that we were like the only ones who had this connection. For them, that might as well have been in another country. That's up there in North Alabama. We don't know any of those people. And so we felt a little bit alone in our grief. And I think there are other times, and I think when we lose a loved one, maybe to some degree people understand, but at some level they're not in the same boat. As much as possible, I think this is the idea. It's almost like hospitality. Put yourself in the same boat, or at least try to make them feel like you're in the boat with them. And come alongside and let them know that it's okay and that you're there to grieve with them. Well, I want to say this. Sometimes there's a grief that calls for assistance. We talk about this sometimes and say, people who are grieving aren't looking for you to come and fix their problems. Well, very often that is the case. Sometimes they actually are, though. In the book of Nehemiah, in Nehemiah chapter 1 and in verse 4, we find Nehemiah has gotten word of what's happening in Jerusalem. And it's bad news. The situation is not encouraging, to say the least. And it tells us his reaction in verse 4, when I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Well, you can't sit down and mourn and weep for days and fast without it having an effect on your appearance. And so it did. And over in chapter 2 and beginning in verse 2, it tells us that the king said to him, why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. And I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire? Well, the king then, I'm sure are familiar with the story, comes back and says, well, what can we do about this? Let me give you some resources. Let me give you permission to go back and do something about this. And of course, Nehemiah is very encouraged by that, right? That's exactly what he wanted. So it wasn't a situation where there's nothing you can do. In fact, in this case, there was something that could be done. And so, I know we ask a lot of times what can we do, and we sort of that becomes almost cliche, and we almost say it expecting there's nothing you can do. Sometimes there really is. So ask that, ready to actually hear an answer. Sometimes. That yes, there's actually something that you can do. I've even seen situations where somebody is so used to saying that, and then it's almost like, whoa, I mean, that was just sort of like a greeting. I didn't mean it. And we need to mean it. And we need to be ready to do what we can, even though very often I know that that's not the case. Of course, there are many times where all we can do is be near. I mentioned Job chapter 2 and verse 13. I mentioned Job's friends this morning who come and they sit for 7 days. and the difficulty that we have with that. I think it's hard maybe sometimes for us to understand the comfort of just having somebody near. The first meeting that Brother Waldron held for us after Sister Waldron had passed away. He came and he was working on his commentary, and so he's on the computer and making his own Hebrew translation of the Old Testament, and you know, just working. And we were all in the den, and we each had a book in our hand, and including the girls, they had their little books. They were pretty small at that point, but they were reading their books. So we're all four sitting in our living room, and we're reading our books. And Brother Waldron came in there with his stack of papers, and he says, "Do you all mind if I sit down here in here with you?" And we were like, "Well, that'd be fine." He goes, "This is what I like to call companionable silence, and I miss it." And he didn't want us to, in fact, he really didn't want us to say anything. He was working. He was busy. But he just loved that there were people right there with him while he was doing it, because he'd been so used to that his whole life, is to have his helpmate right there by his side. And he might every once in a while say, "Can I tell y'all something interesting I just discovered?" Well, of course, we'd be happy to. But for the most part, we just sat there quietly. And it was a great comfort. And it was a picture to me of what a comfort that can be, that we're just sitting together. That, in days gone by, that was an activity that most people participated in, is sitting together, front porch sitting. And it was an expectation. There were wakes that were had. Everybody just shows up and we just sit. And as a kid, you go to those sort of things. What are we doing? We're helping. Just by being there and having a big old crowd in the room. And there's value that maybe we've lost. And we need to grab hold of it again and appreciate that and understand that that's value that's commended by the Scriptures. As far as bringing truth into it and the promises of God that we talked about this morning, that we sang about just a moment ago, truth is a great comfort, but truth can also be used as a great afflictor. And we need to be careful about how we approach using truth to comfort someone. In the book of Job, his friends say a lot of true things that are true in and of themselves, but they use them in such a way with implication that's almost turns it into accusation. It's not, "Here, Job, here's some comforting words," but rather they say things like this in Job chapter 5 and verse 8. It says here, "As for me, I would seek God. And I would place my cause before God, who does great and unsearchable things, wonders without number." And then he goes on to talk about all the wonders that God does. So here's Eliphaz, and I think that's not maybe an inaccurate tone to represent that in. As you read through his commentary, that he comes in and he goes, "Well, you know, Job, I think I'd go to God. You know, God can do great things." And of course, Job's response to that tone, as it continues throughout the rest of his friends' speeches, we see over in chapter 12 and verse 3. He says, well, beginning in verse 2, "Truly then, you are the people, and with you wisdom will die. But I have intelligence as well as you. I am not inferior to you. And who does not know such things as these? I am a joke to my friends, the one who called on God and he answered him. The just man, the just and blameless man is a joke." They don't come to Job saying, "I know you know this, but I'm going to tell you some things that are such a great comfort." They come to him almost like, "Job, you seem to have forgotten some things, and we're here to instruct you, because you seem like a simpleton." And Job is saying, "Who do you think you're talking to? Now you might think, well, Job's response is kind of hostile. I'm sure you don't think that because we know the nature of the book. But I can imagine his friends thinking that. We're just sitting here trying to be helpful. Well, you're not. You're not. Not when you come in that sort of exalted way and you're not sitting along beside and saying, you know, one of the things that was most comforting to me or one of the thoughts that lifts me up is this. You are standing up here and saying downward towards Job, listen here. I'm going to instruct you like we've just set up Sunday school here. And it's an affliction. And they continued to afflict Job with their truth. And of course, they said things that were not true. But more often than saying things that were not true, they said true things and misapplied them or applied them in untrue ways. And I think that's the biggest mistake that you have in the friends of Job. That's a far cry from 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and the comfort one another with these words. I don't know how many funerals I have read these words and heard these words read. And I cannot tell you that I've ever been to a funeral and heard them read and I thought, oh, I'm just so tired of that. I told one guy, I was going to be speaking at his mother's funeral. And I said, I'm going to read some of the familiar passages. I said, I hope that's okay. It's not going to be unique. And he said, unique? Those are the best passages. And so we read 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. We went over to 2 Timothy chapter 4 and we read Paul's benediction and thought of it in terms of his mother having finished the course and having a crown of righteousness laid up. And there's tears. There's tears because even though those words have been heard 100 times over, right now they hit in a way that they never have before. Because now they apply very specifically. So, it's not that it's cliche. Cliche is not the problem. It's sometimes we just come in with the wrong tone and the wrong approach, and we want to be careful about that. We want to use truth in ways that's not like scolding with truth, especially when what we're meaning to do is comfort with truth. Well, finally, as we're approaching the grief of others, we just want to be thoughtful in our comments and questions. We want to apply the golden rule. Whatever you would have men do unto you, do unto them. The first place that I began to preach full time 20 years ago, over 20 years ago now, I preached 7 funerals in the first year, I think. It may have been more than that, but somewhere around that. It's an older congregation, the young people, the younger crowd was made up of people in their 50s. And so there were a lot of people in nursing homes and already nearing the end of their life when I got there. And there was one older lady, and most of these people had been staples in that congregation. I didn't know them very well, but everybody else obviously did, and that offered some challenges. I remember going to the hospital in one particular instance, and I got there. I was on my way to the hospital, and I got there right after she had died. So it was kind of a shock, a little bit to me. I mean, we knew that was coming, but I still didn't expect it to have happened before I got there. So I walked in, and the daughter-in-law told me, she said, she just passed. I was like, oh. I said, well, how is everybody? And the look on her face, she was like, well, not good. Okay. I was 21 years old. And so she said that, and I thought, okay, obviously, that was a dumb question. You learn from moments, and you learn by being on both sides of those moments, that you say things and phrase things. And I'm not saying asking people how they are is always a terrible thing. In fact, there's different tones that you can kind of go about that, and I think that was part of the problem there, is I just, you know, I didn't know, and it caught me off guard, and I just, in the wrong tone, in the wrong thing, I just said something. So we're going to do that sometimes. Well, remember those moments. When you're going through the funeral line, think about what can I say? What is helpful? Sometimes we want to say, I don't want to say what everybody else is saying. Everybody else is saying, I'm so sorry about your loss. What else could I say? Well, let me just say, one of the reasons everybody says that is it's a solid thing to say. And if you can't think of something better, that'll do. That'll do just fine. And I think maybe along the way we're like, what else could I say? And then something comes out and maybe we've added to the pain and we didn't mean to. But we just weren't being very thoughtful. So we want to be thoughtful. And when you do ask questions like, how are you? Understand, like I think some people, I mean, obviously, how are you doing? That's a greeting. That's something that we give back and forth. Hi, how are you? In fact, if you're learning Spanish, that's one of the greetings you will learn, right? ¿Cómo estás? How are you? Right. That's what you ask. And then you're taught a response. And let me just tell you, the response is that you're taught is not muy mal, which is very bad. No, you're taught bueno, right? I'm doing good. Everything's fine. And it's just a normal interaction. But when somebody is grieving and you say, how are you? You need to be ready for an answer. And it may be not good. We're doing okay. Or, well, how long have you got? Because I can explain to you a little bit about how we're doing, but if you're just asking by greeting, then we're okay. So be thoughtful as you're entering into that conversation. Try to remember what it's like to be on the other side of that conversation and try to think of ways to approach that are sympathetic and compassionate to the person sitting on the other side. I will say this. One of the things that I consistently hear from people who have lost loved ones, and I've talked to a lot of people, I talked to my sister a lot about this, is that people get very squeamish about saying the name of the departed. And she said, but I don't ever want to stop hearing the name. So don't say just your spouse or your child or your mom. Maybe there's appropriate times for that. But to say to my sister, something about Owen, it's music. It doesn't set her off and make her cringe and think, oh, I don't want to think about that. No, I don't want to stop thinking about that ever. And so that is a sort of a thing that I think where we're trying to think of what to say and we're worried about being offensive. I feel like pretty universally people say, feel free to talk especially about good memories about the people that we love and have lost. Well, here is an aspect of grief that I want to speak carefully about. That there is value in grief. I think we all know this. I think this can get a little bit distorted as we talk about the value of grief. We can almost go so far as to talk about it as if the thing that caused the grief is what has the value. Don't misunderstand. Right? When tragedy occurs, it's called tragedy for a reason. It's called affliction for a reason. God isn't saying that in and of itself is good, but it produces good things. And those are the things that we can be thankful for. So, laughter may be the best medicine, but tears are far better teachers. And that's what we learn from Ecclesiastes. It's not that joy and laughter and mirth don't have good effect. We see that. Like, there's an appropriate time for that. And there's an appropriate comfort that goes along with that. But we don't want to just shove aside the grief so energetically and so quickly that we don't get the good out of it. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Because, he says, that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. That's what we want to do. Sorrow is better than laughter. For when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise, then, is in the house of mourning, while the mind of the fools is in the house of pleasure. I appreciated Brother Hall, that while he may relay some lighthearted stories along the way, it was not lost it wasn't a sermon, I don't know what you call that, benediction would be an official word, I guess. But anyway, it wasn't lost in his presentation that there was tremendous grief. I think so much of our funerals, we've even called them, we don't call them funerals anymore. We're not, it's not a time of sorrow, it's a celebration. Well, I get that. But that is a house of mourning. And we almost want to make it into stand-up night. Tell all the funny jokes. We want to make sure people laugh the whole time. I remember going to a funeral in Montgomery where that was the case. It was laughs start to finish. And I think one of the reasons it was laughs is if we had stopped for a moment to actually consider the life of the man who had passed, tears is all we would have had. Because it was not a nobly lived life. And Larry Rouse was there, and I remember Larry saying to me, I don't know how many people there today were laughing who will laugh themselves all the way to hell. Right past every lesson they could have learned today. Because they couldn't allow a single moment of sober reflection. We need it. Even when there's joy to be had, we need that sober reflection. And so we need to leave room for that. Through tears, we learn how much dependency we have on God. Through sorrow, we learn how incapable we are of taking away the pain. I want to teach people from God's Word how much personal responsibility they have. We talked about that with regards to grief over sin, that God says, hey, there's something you can do about that. Now, I want people to see that. But there is a real value in finding out the limits of what you have control over. And I think Paul found that value more than once. I think he talks about it at the beginning of 2 Corinthians, but he also talks about it more and more explicit ways here in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, as he discusses that thorn in the flesh that he desires to be removed and asks to be removed some three times. And it says that the response is, he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, this is Paul's response, most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And the weakness there is that weakness in being able to do anything about my circumstances. I'm so limited. This was an element that Summer and I were talking about several weeks ago as we were talking about grief. And I was telling her some of the things that we've been learning. And she said, I think that was one of the biggest lessons I learned, is that I reached the point of, here is how much power I have over this circumstance, way sooner than I thought I would. Because I thought there were a lot more options. And I thought if I march into the right office and I say the right things, I mean, who could deny, right? And you go home and you feel so helpless. And instead of just simply being helpless and feeling helpless, God says, all right, now what? You're in charge. And being able to understand that at a very deep level, being able to understand how much that is true, and it doesn't matter how much money you have, it doesn't matter how much influence you have, that here's where we go to, And we find that men, not just me, but men are so limited in being able to stop or change whatever is going on in our lives. And so we come to God, and instead of thinking of that in hopeless terms, it forces us to consider the hopefulness that it's Him that I must rely on. Tears can also make us think more purposefully towards the eternal. That is the point of 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13 through 18. That when we are sorrowing, that's where our minds turn, especially when our sorrow is over the loss of loved ones. But let me say, it's not just that. Just in general, when we're suffering pain, we begin to think about the life that is beyond this one. I think of Paul as he is in prison and he's writing to the brethren in Philippi. And he says in chapter 1 and verse 23, he says, I am hard pressed from both directions, having a desire to part and be with Christ, for that is very much better. It's better even if you're living in the lap of luxury. It's particularly better if you're in prison. But he says, yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. There are times when we go through sorrow such that what we recognize is, I have just lost one more thing that might tie me to this world. And in one sense, at least, that's not a bad thing. To realize, I've got one more reason to want to be out of here. Wanting to be out of here is exactly where we want to be. Wanting to be able to say, Lord, come quickly, is exactly where we want to be. And so if sorrow can get me closer to there, all right then. Then I will go through that to get to where I need to be. Over in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6. In this he says, you greatly rejoice. Even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. So that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor. The revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen Him, you love Him. And though you do not see Him now, but believe in Him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. You're going through all of this, and it's so heavy and difficult, and they're wondering why. And He says, look to the end. That's why. And the more you contemplate that, the more joy inexpressible that you can have even in the middle of all of that. It can bring us also to greater devotion. In Psalm 119, and in verse 67, the psalmist says, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I keep your word. Again, in verse 71, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I may learn your statutes. Well, that coincides right along with what the Hebrew writer says in chapter 12 of his letter. Hebrews chapter 12 and beginning in verse 4, where he says, You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, and you're striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by Him. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines, and He scourges every son whom He receives. Now, as you read through that, as you read through the whole context, there's some shortcomings in the recipients of this letter, but it doesn't seem to be that this is discipline in the sense of punitive, but rather discipline as instructive. You're being put through this for your benefit, and there's value at the other end of it. And so, like Job, who's a righteous man but goes through affliction, he comes out, even though he was already upright in a way that God says there's no one else like him on the earth. Yet Job could go through affliction and end up in a place even more refined than he began. So he could learn and become better and more devoted to God, more trusting of God than he already was, which is saying something by going through that. And so can we. Along those lines, there is a closeness that comes through grief. There is firstly a closeness that comes to God through affliction. And that's really what we're talking about all through these verses. He is near the brokenhearted and the afflicted. And so that is a great promise. But there is also a great closeness that comes with each other during grief that really doesn't happen in the same way at any other time. In James chapter 4, I think James even encourages this closeness, encourages us to invite that closeness. In James chapter 5 and in verse 14, is anyone among you sick? Then he must call for the elders of the church, and they are to pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. That is an intimate moment there. And it's one that is brought about because of affliction. Now, I think he's talking about a spiritual weakness, a spiritual sickness. But even if it's physical sickness, it's bringing you closer. And that's what he's saying. Get closer in that relationship with those leaders in the church there. How many times have you seen grief that erases old feuds? That there are people who haven't spoken to each other. I've been there. I've been at funerals where there's relatives, brothers and sisters who haven't spoken to each other in years. But as they stand in front of the sobriety of that moment, they realize how small that is. And it brings people together in a way that, as I say, nothing else can. Now we can't go through that sort of emotional weight 24 hours a day. Some people would almost want to manufacture that kind of emotional moment. You can't do that. I'm not saying that the value that's brought of grief here means we ought to run towards grief or towards the things that bring grief. It's more of appreciate it and don't overlook that value while you're going through. And it's a help to be able to see that while you're going through grief. And it's a help as you look back, as you're coming through grief, you're looking back and you're seeing all those lessons. It helps you as you're moving forward past that grief. Well, that brings us to the last point, and that is the end of grief. Ultimately, that's the goal, is to get to the other side. Somebody was writing on this subject and they said, you know, one of the things that you need to understand is that people, sometimes they don't want to get rid of grief, and you need to just let them have that as long as they want to. And I think, I understand there's a need to give patience and not set a kind of time limit as we talked about this morning. But it's almost like some people will actually embrace it in an unhealthy way. They'll just wrap their arms around it. Don't want to let it go. It's interesting to me that Job, his rebuke to his friends is not, stop trying to cheer me up. That's not it. That's not the problem. It's just, you guys do a really bad job of cheering people up. That's the problem. In chapter 16, similar to what he said in chapter 12, he says in verse 3, is there no limit to windy words, or what plagues you that you answer? I too could speak like you if I were in your place. I could compose words against you and shake my head at you. And it says here, I could. Some of your translations, the New King James, for instance, says I would. And I think that probably fits better. I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the solace of my lips would lessen your pain. And so what I think Job is saying is, I could talk just like you, but if But if you were in my shoes and I was, that's not what I would do. If I was in your shoes, I would say nice things to you. And I would cheer you up. And I would try as much as possible to take away your grief. I think the balance needs to be that we are trying to take someone's grief away. We are trying to be helpful. We're trying to say encouraging things. The balance needs to be that we don't need to think that's going to be immediate. But it is the goal. Like, it is there as a thing that we want to pursue. And if you're the one going through grief, you say, look, I can't just get over this. Granted, but don't you want to? Like, isn't that a thing that you want to move forward and you want to move past this? I think people are afraid to move past grief, and I think that they're afraid for any number of reasons. Some people are afraid to move past grief because of what it might say about their loyalty to the person that they're grieving over. If I stop being sad, then maybe that means I didn't love them very much. And people feel that way. And that's what people, if they're being honest, sometimes will confess. You know, there's a place for continued occasions of sobriety, of sorrow and mourning. But to make your life into a perpetual mourning is not the goal of Christians. I knew a family who lost a teenage son. Tragic car accident. Lost a few brethren in that car accident. And they made their house into a museum. Into a very sober museum. And their younger son, you know, there was no room for laughter in that place. Now, I know there are places where that's right. I mean, you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and they'll flat out tell you, this is not a place for laughter. Nothing funny in there. And you're meant to take that in and be sober. But you want to live in there. You can't. It'll destroy you. And I think in many ways it did destroy them and their faith, because they could not have any sort of pleasant thought at all. And I do think that they felt like it was a betrayal, like it was communicating to people that this was not tragic and that it doesn't really matter to us, that it was no big deal. I feel that sometimes. I'll just be honest with you. I absolutely feel that. I think sometimes people assume that if I am able to laugh and carry on an easy conversation, maybe things are going better. I've even had people say that. Say, well, hey, look, are things going better? And No, they're not. Oh. And it's like they're confused. Well, you're not crying 24/7. No, I can't. I can't live there. I have other things that I've got to do. I've got to get up every day and I got to move on. And so it concerns me even. I have to work through that in my mind, that if I don't go around with a long face, people are going to think that what we're dealing with is no big deal. And frankly, what I have to do is get over it. I'm not really at the end of the day worried about that. But I at least understand it. I understand that people are worried that if they put on a happy face, that people won't know. Well, let me just say, they won't. They won't. And Jesus even instructs the Pharisees, when they are fasting, which is an indication of sadness, make it look like you're not. And so there's a place for that. In Matthew chapter 10, I think, is another example of what makes us afraid to move on. It's not an entirely identical comparison, but think about this. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 14, it says, whoever does not receive you nor heed your words as you go out of that house or that city, shake the dust off your feet. Kevin was telling me about a mutual friend of ours whose brother made a shipwreck of his faith. Somebody Kevin knew very well. And so he asked this mutual friend of ours about that. Our mutual friend, gospel preacher, said he made his choices. I think some people might look at that and say, well, that man's just callous. No, I guarantee you that wasn't his first response. I know all the efforts that he made, pleading with tears. And he's been through all of that, and he had to get to a place where he could stand up and say, I got to move on. I got to try to save other people because he don't want to hear it. And so sometimes we think because somebody had, we don't want to be on the other side of putting that kind of pressure. If somebody does move past their grief, don't ever assume that it's because, after all, they've hardened their heart somehow. People think that about foster parents. I've heard that said to foster parents. Boy, you must just not, things just must not get to you. You got to be kidding me. It is crushing. But you do it anyway. You don't do it because you've hardened your heart. You don't move past this because you've hardened your heart. But you have learned to accept it. And you've learned to move forward, looking ahead at what lies before us. We need to learn to set aside our grief, even while the grief is still surrounding us, even while it's still in front of us. In Luke chapter 22, we have the picture of the Lord's grief in the Garden of Gethsemane as he prays. And we have that intense language describing his grief, with the tears, the sweat becoming rather as drops of blood and falling down upon the ground in verse 44. But then it says, when he arose from prayer, he came to his disciples and found them sleeping from sorrow and said to them, why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you may not enter into temptation. And while he's speaking, the crowd comes, and then he has his interaction with them. And if we're not careful, there's two possibilities here. First of all, maybe you think that Jesus maybe wasn't that in so much agony, because after all, he was able to get up and move on pretty quickly. Or maybe we separate those and we don't realize how quickly Jesus, in fact, did have to get up from his agony and get back to work and go about his business. For us right now, we are living in a constant limbo. And many of you may be in similar circumstances. I know that there are people who live in that because they are caring for someone. I know that the Gossett family has lived there for a while in some ways. In that you're already processing grief even though it's not got here yet. And then it finally does. And all you do is you just hope you can push it off a little bit further. But you know it's coming. And so what do? Well, you can lose yourself in that. Or you can say, look, I'm going to have my times where I've got to go to the garden. I've got to sit down and I've got to cry. But then there's a call and I don't have any choice, but I got to get up and I've got to go do the things. I got kids to raise. I got a wife to care for. I've got a congregation of people who need to hear not just me crying up here, but hopeful words from God. And so I don't have time to just waste all my time away sitting and crying, even though I've got tears to spare. And so we don't look at the picture of Jesus' sorrow and find permission to just stay there. Jesus got right back up and he got right back to work, even though that's agony I don't even know about. And it is a great inspiration to look at. And it's not just his inspiration, but it's a great many other people that I see just going about their business. And I know it's not because there are no tears being shed. I know it's because they have to grab hold of the Lord and his promises, pull themselves up again by his promises, and get back to work. Ultimately, the cause of grief, it's got to be dulled, at least dulled, by the reality that we are living for something that is so grand that it makes these sorrows, whatever they are, small by comparison. Romans chapter 8 and in verse 18. Paul says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time, they're not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us." Let me just say, that does not just apply to the person who has lost a loved one in Christ. If you lose a loved one who does not know God, who has rejected God, you know what God has said about that, and there's no comfort. I suggest to you, even there, Paul says, that is not worthy to be compared with what awaits us. So this is not just a comforting passage for people who already have other comforts. This is a comforting passage for somebody who feels like they have no comfort. And I feel some ways like that for us. Because people say, "Well, I'm sure this will work out." Well, let me just say, I'm not. And they'll say something like, "Well, I'm sure if he goes back in that direction, he'll mess up and he'll come right back to you." Let me just say, that's not a great comfort. Because I shudder at what that means. My greatest fear is him being raised by somebody who does not know God or care about God, losing him to the world. And I believe this says God's reward can overwhelm that grief. Boy, I got to hold on to that. And when he says, "I will wipe away every tear," those two, even those, we have to get to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And verse 30. That we are to be like those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. And those who buy as though they did not possess. Those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away. How can you not just be overwhelmed by that because of that? Because I don't weep like the rest of the world. My sorrow is not like the world's sorrow. Because I'm tied to something that's greater. That can help me see past even sorrow that goes on, seems to go on into the eternal. Because God promises it won't. Not yours. Not if you cling to me. I'll take it all away. I can't imagine that there's somebody here who doesn't want that. Somebody here who can contemplate a time where not a single thing causes pain, that you wouldn't think, "I would want to be there above all else. I need to be there." Don't you want to live in such a way that not only do you have that hope, but live in such a way that even your tears right now are valuable? That there's something worthwhile to them. Even better, that they are reminders that we're aiming for something far better. And so he says, come, enter in, and let me comfort and remove all of your tears. If you would respond to that invitation in any way, if we could help you, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?